this week's program, we drop in on the latest exhibition at the Brandywine River Museum. Factory Work examines the relationships between pop artists Andy Warhol and realist painter Jamie Wyeth and graffiti artist Jean-Michel Basquiat. Jason Pfeiffer speaks with the composer of Windy City, the first show in the Walnut Street Theatre's new season. And Susan Lewis looks back on 2 weeks accompanying the Philadelphia Orchestra on its recent tour of Europe's summer music festivals. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
And before we get to all of those intriguing stories which we were promising you this morning, we'd like to intrigue you to the telephone at this point. A new hour and a new goal, and we're looking for, in this hour, Jack.
Yes.
We're
looking, 18 members.
18 members.
Yes. So we need to start right now.
You need to start right now. The telephone number to show your support for this and all of the programming you hear on WRTI, 1-866-809-9784. 866-809-9784.
That is the number. And we continue on with Creatively Speaking this morning. But let me throw it at you one more time. 1-866-809-9784.
The latest exhibition at the Brandywine River Museum, which opens this morning, examines the curious collaborative relationships between pop artist Andy Warhol and younger artists Jamie Wyeth and Jean-Michel Basquiat, each with very different styles. Factory Work, Warhol, Wyeth and Basquiat features works by all three painters, as well as interviews, clippings and audio tapes exploring the relationships between Warhol and the younger men. Throughout his career, Warhol was known for bringing younger artists into his New York studio, The Factory. He was a mentor, but also found inspiration in the talents of those he guided. Jamie Wyeth became friends with Andy Warhol in the early 1970s. Wyeth was an established realist painter, and following in his grandfather N.C. and father Andrew's footsteps, he was seen as the crown prince of American representational art. In 1976, Warhol offered Wyeth studio space at the factory, and for several months the two men worked together, painting multiple portraits of each other and producing several acclaimed shows. Jean-Michel Basquiat, the son of Puerto Rican and Haitian parents, and made his reputation by embracing graffiti art and the countercultural life when he sought out Warhol in the 80s. He and Warhol also painted each other's portraits and collaborated on several works. Many of these collaborations were exhibited in 1985. Warhol passed in 1987. 1 year later, the 27-year-old Basquiat would die from a heroin overdose. Joyce Hill Stoner is the curator of this new three-man show. She says it will help to put straight some of Andy Warhol and Jamie Wyeth's shared history.
Jamie is left out of the Warhol historiography. And so one of the exciting things about this exhibition is getting people to realize this was a real friendship. And so with the show, we have the Warhol-Wyeth friendship showing the celebrity-obsessed decade of the 70s, then the Warhol-Basquiat friendship, which is a little better known, of the 80s, which is all about the money-mad art market. So it's sort of the two very distant poles of Andy Warhol. He was nicknamed Drella by the factory people, a combination of Cinderella and Dracula, because the idea was he would meet young people and suck their life juices to recharge his own batteries.
Earlier this week, as the show was being hung, I spoke to Jamie Wyeth at the Brandywine River Museum.
In retrospect, I mean, I think he was intrigued by that I was painting. He kept saying, you know, he hadn't smelled oil paint ever. And, you know, he looked at my palette as I was working. And, I mean, what I really learned, I think, from him was the keen observation that he did. I mean, to me, painting is recording. And the keener the recorder you are, the more interesting it is. And you take the body of his work, and, you know, he was an amazing. He had his finger right on that pulse going along. And that just intrigued the hell out of me, you know. And maybe even more of a recorder wanting to record things.
Because you had obviously at that stage had the experience of having had a rather well-qualified mentor all of your life prior to that. So you were somebody who knew how to, I would guess, get the best out of somebody who had a different knowledge to you.
I guess. I don't know. Again, my mission in my mind was just to record this sort of uncanny figure. And, you know, all the rest was sort of peripheral. And then It was a space to work, and so I just took to full advantage of it. You know, it was a great. But there's in the catalog, there's one of the interesting essays is by this Robert Rosenblum, who's a big critic now, and the title of it is Identity Theft. And it was really that Warhol was sucking it out of us, you know, sucking it out of Jean Michel and sucking it out of me, which is great. Why not, you know?
It's 30 years later now. When you look back at the paintings you did of him and the recordings he made of you, how have they changed over the years? How has your view of them changed over the years?
I think mine, I hope, is pretty honest record of him. And that I did endless drawings of him.
Do you remember the artist you were then, now?
Not really. I mean, I think I'm applying the same sort of things that I was applying then, I hope. His record of me was sort of, I mean, sort of legitimized. One time we were talking about toys, and he said as a child he was bedridden and ill, and his favorite toys were paper dolls. Well, if you look at all his portraits, they really are paper doll images. These cut-out eyes and all these transvestites made to look beautiful, and, you know, he had that. So that to me, legitimized him even more, you know. It just intrigued the hell out of me.
Can we take a look at some of your images of Warhol and maybe have a conversation about them? A lot of studies here as well. Warhol studies
of
you.
Yeah, there are many, many more here. This one over here, for instance, if he would... holding this is I use calipers where I would measure the exact size, and I was just intrigued. And at one point, the cardboard I was using was too small for a full figure, so I attached the bottom part, glued it on. And at the end of our year of working together, he gave me a portrait done of me. So I said, "Well, Andy, what do you want?" He said, "Oh, I want the feet."
So he got the feet.
And then when he died, he left it to me in his will, which is rather
that's
nice.
Amazing. If we can describe this, it's a portrait of Andy Warhol. I mean, that's not scale. He wasn't.
Yes, that,
sure.
That
really was that short.
No. But you see, it's cut
off.
Yeah,
that's
added
that.
To it.
Yeah.
So it would be somebody, you know, this high.
So this is oil on cardboard.
It's combined medium and cardboard. It's a profile, and there he's holding his dog Archie, and the wig, as you can see, placed on it. And he would sort of walk around the factory, you know, observing everybody. I mean, here would be some incredible sort of, you know, drag queen in some regalia, and he just stands like, "Oh, that's really great." Then he'd walk onto another thing, and, you know, "Oh, that's really great." And the whole time, he bugged himself. He had tape recorders and microphones in the end of his sleeves and recorded everything. And the next day, there were a whole bank of little young kids who would transcribe all this stuff. For what reason? I have no idea. And they say in the Warhol Museum today, there's still unopened boxes of tapes of just, you know, recording everything in his life.
You say that he was fascinated by you because you came from this great tradition of American painting. But by the same degree, you also came from this great tradition of draftsmanship and craftsmanship.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that he had respect for that? Because a lot of the artists he would have been working from would have been very stream of consciousness.
Yeah, and running the other way. Yes, no, I think he really did have a real interest. I mean, as evidenced by when he died, you know, the window of his house. I was only allowed in there three times, but it was just, you know, packed with, he was just a shopper like he wouldn't believe. But among Fiesta ware and things like that were some great paintings and great drawings, and so he clearly had an interest in that too.
Okay, last question. Let's bring two fairly well-established artists into your studio today.
I wouldn't allow it, of course.
You wouldn't allow it?
No. I mean, I can't stand to have anybody around, you know.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
It's totally a solitary activity for you, though.
For me, it is.
It has to be.
Except, obviously, when I work on a portrait, mm-hmm. the person has to be there, but I find it very difficult having somebody there. Warhol was able to have, you know, this whole circus going on, and me, too, sitting there examining his pores and his pimples and everything. And you know, I mean, he wore makeup and he glued those eyebrows on every morning. So even more amazing that he let me get, you know, like this. Of course, he said later that if he had the portrait, he'd put it in a closet.
Jamie Wyeth. Factory work, Warhol, Wyeth, and Basquiat is at the Brandywine River Museum from today until November 19th. And we are here from today until this day week, until next Saturday, asking for your pledges at 1-866-809-9784. A goal of 18 pledges in this hour. We've so far had two.
Right.
Thank you very much. Congratulations. Welcome aboard. It's It's great to see you showing your support for WRTI for all the various types of programming that we bring you here, and we appreciate it greatly. Why don't you now decide that it's your time? Saturday mornings can be very busy. Maybe you're out doing errands or grocery shopping. Maybe you're in the car now and you're not going to be in a few moments, and maybe the moment will pass and you'll have missed the opportunity to show your support. You do that by going to the phone. Maybe take that cell phone out of your pocket if you're driving. Maybe pull over to the side. Might be a good
idea. Yeah.
And dial this number.
1-866-809-9784. Now, I have to tell you, and I've done this before, and you just brought it back to mind, is that I've listened to fun drives before for other things on the radio and said, you know, I should really do that. And then I said, I let the moment pass, and I forget about it. And
it really does happen.
Yeah,
it took me, I think, a couple. Well, no, the first year I was here, I was a member, and then I let it lapse. And I had said to them, please don't send me anything because I don't want you to waste the money on postage, because I wasn't an elite member in terms of my contribution.
Right.
And again, it was a little while before I got back to it. So if maybe you have let your membership lapse, maybe this would be a very good time for you to decide that, hey, that's something I really, really did support, and I continue to support, and I continue to listen to WRTI. Therefore, I'm going to vote now with my feet.
Right.
By going to the phone and dialing 1-866-809-9784. One more time, more slowly. 1-866-809-9784.
You know that, and Jim does it, and Jill does it too. A lot of work goes into these programs that you hear on Saturday mornings because they love what they do.
Love it.
And they want to share it with you. And Jim's visit, for instance, with Jamie Wyeth right there is a prime example of that.
Fascinating man, actually. Yeah. He's a very, very, very pleasant individual to be around, and amazing looking. We thought there was a mistake in the bio, but he's 60 years of age now.
Wow.
And looks in his 30s and has a very relaxed attitude to the world. A very interesting character.
Well, the fascinating thing about all that is that where else would you hear something like that?
Nowhere. Where nobody else is doing. You're not going to hear Jamie Wyeth's voice unless it's on a museum tour.
Right, right. So that is a prime reason to call. 1-866-809-9784.
Earlier this week, the Philadelphia Orchestra returned from its six-city, 10-concert tour of European music festivals. WRTI's Susan Lewis traveled with the orchestra, and now, newly refreshed and relatively un-jet-lagged, she takes a look back at 2 weeks of taking notes from the road.
Taking an orchestra on tour is quite an undertaking, and some might wonder if it's worth it in this day of instant communications, digital sound, and internet downloading. This, however, was not an ordinary orchestra tour. If any tour of 120-plus musicians, stagehands, 8 staff, tour doctor, and assorted family members and guests qualifies as that. This was a European festivals tour, something the orchestra does every 10 years or so, making stops at summer music festivals in Frankfurt, Lucerne, Hamburg, Essen, Bonn, and Berlin, and finishing up at the renowned Proms in London. Taking classical repertoire to the great music festivals of Europe might seem like bringing Coles to Newcastle, or bringing Beethoven to, well, the home of Beethoven, as in the orchestra's concert in Bonn, the birthplace of the great composer. But festivals are exciting and important showcases, as orchestra librarian Bob Grossman describes.
There's an excitement always when we go on the tour, but the festival tours a more exciting audience, and you know that you're in an atmosphere where you're going back to back with all the other leading orchestras and ensembles.
The publicity value of touring has appeal for corporate sponsors, as well as the Philadelphia Convention and Visitors Bureau, which sent people along to promote the city. If touring could be likened to a musical marathon, this trip started out with a jog, a 3-day stretch in Frankfurt as the musicians adjusted to jet lag and reunited with instruments that had been shipped separately. The orchestra opened the tour at the Alter Oper as part of the Rheingau Music Festival with the 5th symphonies of Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. Momentum built as the orchestra played 3 programs over 3 days at Switzerland's prestigious Lucerne Festival, founded in 1938 by Arturo Toscanini. Here in a lakeside setting, complete with gliding white swans and the Swiss Alps rising into the sky, the orchestra showcased the old masters as well as a contemporary work by composer Matthias Pinscher, who likened his piece, entitled Herodiad Fragments, to theater.
a soloist, an instrument, or a solo piano becomes a character which is expressing something, trying to communicate something to the audience.
Drama and emotion were also what soloist Marisol Montalvo was going for in her singing and her dress.
What I wear matches what I sing. Pinter is Salome, and when she doesn't get what she wants, she's crazy. And the dress was to reflect dripping in blood because she took John the Baptist's head. So I wanted everything that represented youth, sexuality, death. Pretty good, huh, for a dress?
After a day off in picturesque, though rainy, Lucerne, the orchestra flew back to Germany, where it played a concert a night in the cities of Hamburg, Essen, Bonn, and Berlin. Although the travel was intense, the group got a break from airport lines, taking a more relaxed and scenic route through the German countryside.
It's so civilized.
I love the train because it gives me a chance to catch up with my colleagues.
I'm going to just catch up on some email and then take a nap.
It beats walking.
Touring through Europe gave some musicians a chance to seek out European relatives and friends. A lifelong friendship forged by music was renewed by violinist Jerry Wiegler. Wiegler was a 20-year-old GI medic during the invasion of Normandy and liberation of Paris in World War II. One day, while guarding a train carrying hospital supplies just outside of Paris, he began making music in a most basic way.
Something popped into my mind, a string quartet of Beethoven, the F major, opus 59, and while I whistled the opening theme, which all of a sudden, someone in the crowd whistled, which was the second part of the phrase. It was a young boy who must have been about 16. We remained friends since 1944, since that incident. I just can't wait to see them. Jean Paul Mali, his name is.
And you know, he was the only soldier marching with the violin case.
Mali and Wiegler reunited in Essen.
I remember that too. But
after Friday's concert in Berlin, the orchestra packed their bags for London, the last stop on the tour. Two concerts were scheduled in the Royal Albert Hall as part of the Proms, a festival started in 1895 as the Henry Wood Promenade Concerts. Both Philadelphia Orchestra performances were to be broadcast live on national television and radio by the BBC.
For the first time in the 112-year history of the Proms, a concert has been canceled.
Orchestra President James Underkoffler, when Sunday's concert was called off, a small fire had broken out backstage in the musicians' lounge, triggering the sprinklers and shorting out the electrical system. But no one was hurt, musicians' instruments were not damaged, and Monday's concert went on as planned, much to the great relief of everyone, including music director Christoph Eschenbach.
People are queuing still around the hall, trying to get in, and it's a great atmosphere.
The line to get in was no surprise. These concerts were conceived to make orchestral music available to large numbers of people. Proms director Nicholas Kenyon says that the key thing about the Proms is its audience. The Proms are still known as a way into classical music for a whole generation of listeners. It's also always been a bargain.
You only need to pay £5, which hardly buys you a pint of beer or a glass of wine in London.
The circular Royal Albert Hall holds nearly 6,000 people, with standing room for 1,400, 900 of those on the floor in the center in the front of the stage. The audiences are beloved by performers, like principal timpanist Don Liuzzi.
When the music is on, they are silent. It's really a quiet audience. But beforehand, it's not. They're the performers on the prom floors.
At the last concert's intermission, audience and musicians mingled outside the stage door.
It's part of our musical heritage.
We always look forward to see the visiting orchestras.
It was indeed a grand ending, not just because of the majesty of the music or the splendor of the Royal Albert Hall. Sitting or standing, on stage or off, in that circular space, surrounded by a sea of enthusiastic listeners, showed what touring is all about. The communion of audience and orchestra illustrated and reinforced the power of human connection through art to communicate, unite, and maybe, even in today's world, to heal.
An excerpt from the Philadelphia Orchestra's Monday evening Proms performance of Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. Ending that report by WRTI's Susan Lewis. You can hear that concert in its entirety tomorrow afternoon here on WRTI.
What an interesting trip that must have been for her.
Absolutely.
It's certainly an interesting trip for the orchestra and for the audiences who got to hear
and for our listeners as well, who were getting those daily reports for 12 days and and getting made to feel like you were there a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Next best thing to traveling there.
Right.
And much more inexpensive.
Right.
Think of what your membership of WRTI can achieve. We take you all over the world through the music we play, to the canals of Venice, to the peaks of the Alps, to the fjords of Norway, and beyond.
We went to Norway, steps. Too?
No, I'm just talking about the music.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
And then you also get to travel with the orchestra.
Right.
In a very visceral way, because you do really get a sense of what's been going on, how the concerts have been going on. It was a very eventful tour as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the events not as were planned, right, such as the cancellation of the Albert Hall concert, but they managed to pull it off in the end and finish the tour in style. Why don't you finish this section of your morning in style? There's a very simple way to do that. You show your support, as have five people so far. Thank you so much for your support. It really is great to know that you're there and that you care about what we're doing. 1-866-809-9784.
Two of those being new members, by the way.
Welcome aboard.
Almost
congratulations.
Half. Nice to see them. And if you are one of those people who enjoys listening to these trips that we take with Jim and Jill on Saturday mornings around the area and around the world, and you can travel in that visceral way with us every Saturday morning on Creatively Speaking.
I'm just trying to work out, actually. I think we've got something in the region of 10,000 miles on this week's show.
Wow.
About 9,500 of those were the orchestra. But, you know, Chad's Ford is still a
sure, bit. Sure. All right. Well, you can support that travel and go on the radio trip by pledging your support now to WRTI. 1-866-809-9784 is the toll-free number. Once again, 1-866-809-9784.
In the mid-1920s, Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur, two former Chicago newspaper reporters, wrote a stage comedy called The Front Page. When it opened on Broadway in 1928, it was a smash hit. In the nearly 80 years since the play was written, it's continued to have an active life. It's been adapted to film four times, including the 1940 Howard Hawks movie His Girl Friday. In 1982, a musical version of the story called Windy City premiered in London's West End and subsequently made its way to Chicago. The work has largely been on hiatus over the last decade or so, but this week Windy City returns to the stage of the Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the latest production based on the Front Page play includes a little of the old and the new.
The inspiration for the musical Windy City came over 25 years ago as Tony Macaulay watched the 1974 Billy Wilder film The Front Page. Macaulay found himself drawn to the time period, drama, and comedy of the story.
I thought immediately that this has all the ingredients of a musical.
It's fair to say Macaulay has an ear for music. The longtime British songwriter and music producer has sold over 52 million records worldwide. He's written many top 20 pop songs, including tunes like Build Me Up a Buttercup by The Foundation. In the early 1980s, Macaulay teamed up with American writer and lyricist Dick Vosburgh to create Windy City. Staying true to the premise of the original stage version of The Front Page, the musical is set in the press room of Chicago's Criminal Courts building in 1929. At the center of the story is Hildebrand Johnson, a top reporter for the Chicago Examiner. Johnson is preparing to quit his newspaper job and move to California with his fiancée to work in the movie industry. But with his editor, Walter Burns, conspiring against him, Johnson finds that leaving the Examiner and Chicago is easier said than done. When the Windy City musical premiered in 1982, it was well received, picking up a variety of British theater awards. But after a few years of production both in the UK and the United States, the show eventually ran its course. Macaulay says he hadn't looked at the piece for over a decade when the Walnut Street Theater called, requesting permission to revive the musical.
I said, yes, let's do it again. That'd be wonderful. But now I've looked at it again, I can see places where I think, you know, why did I do that? I can do better.
Once the Walnut Street Theater committed to produce Windy City, Macaulay went to work adding three new songs to the musical. Over the past year, he's also reworked about half of the show's book and score, giving the piece a more modern Broadway sound. With all the changes, Macaulay notes that the Windy City production at the Walnut is not merely a revival. It's practically a new show. One of the people intricately involved in the process of revamping the work over the past year was Mark Robin, the director and choreographer of the Philadelphia production. A former Chicago resident, Robin says his job of directing the show was made easier by already being knowledgeable about the Midwestern city.
It's an environment that I know, and it's talking about locations that literally I know exactly where they are right now in their current form. So the whole sort of history of, or the research of doing the project, it's not like doing Guys and Dolls, for example, trying to look at 1930s New York versus 1930s Chicago. Completely different world, different energies, you know, the whole way that the politics and the money laundering and all that stuff worked in Chicago was very different than the way it worked in New York. So a lot of that stuff I knew because I'd lived in Chicago for 20 years. So I was like, oh, I know, and I like history. So I'd already done that research.
According to Robin, one of the things that's made the front page narrative so compelling to audiences over the last 80 years is the time period the story captures.
There's a glamour to this period. There's a romanticism to the 1930s, even to the 1920s, that whole flapper thing. Starting from the flappers through the 30s to the 40s, contemporary audiences tend to view those as this sort of glamorous film noir style of living. Pieces like Guys and Dolls, City of Angels, and this all have that sort of heightened sensibility to them.
Tony McCauley agrees that there's something extraordinary about the 1920s, as depicted in Windy City. In his view, Hollywood helped to mythologize this era as it was happening.
Usually things are mythologized after they happen. And so much so that people like Al Capone and the other gangster leaders in Chicago went to all the movies, which depicted Hollywood versions of themselves, and started dressing in the way that the gangsters talked. Much in the same happened, of course, when The Godfather came out in about 1970. And the mafia in New York and so on started dressing like the people in the movie and behaving that way. And so it's a fascinating period because there is a contemporaneous record of it on film. And so many wonderful projects have walked in those furrows.
As the Windy City Project is set to open this week, the 62-year-old Tony McCauley reflects that the only career ambition he's yet to realize is having a show on Broadway. With a cast largely made up of Broadway veterans and backing from a large established theater, The Walnut, the revised musical has a lot going for it. McCauley is hopeful that the Windy City's second wind in Philadelphia will give the show the push it needs to make it to the Great White Way.
I've had enough of the Windy City, where the breezes blow your hat away.
The title song from the original Windy City musical, ending that report by Jason Pfeiffer. Windy City opens this Wednesday at the Walnut Street Theater in Philadelphia and runs through October 22nd.
1-866-809-9784 is our toll-free number. Of course, now we're going to be humming Build Me Up Buttercup for the rest of the day today.
No,
thanks a
not.
Lot.
I'm going to be humming Tchaikovsky's Fifth, the last movement.
Okay, very well. 1-866-809-9784. It's a toll-free call. You can call and pledge your membership support. And at the moment, we're looking for 10 members between now and noon today.
And thank you to those people who have become members in the last half hour. Indeed, to all those people who have become members in the last several days.
Half of whom are new members, by the way.
And we really, really appreciate your support. It's so, so good to see that people care enough about this music and this programming that they are prepared to make that extra special effort, because that's what it is. It's a little bit of extra effort to get on the phone, call the number, and decide that this is not a great deal of money. You can start at a $5 per month level, right up to whatever you can afford, and that's what it's about. Put a value on what WRTI's programming means to you, and then go to the phone and dial the number.
1-866-809-9784. 1-866-809-9784.
And that's it for now. Our show written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Thomas Miller, Catherine Blodgett, and Laura Engelhart. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.